Today we salute the flood-ravaged city of New Orleans with perhaps its greatest living musical ambassador, Dr. John, or Mac Rebenack, whose music has always drawn its main sustenance from that city's rich musical gumbo. This interview was recorded last year when Dr. John released New Orleans Dis Dadder to Utter, another look at New Orleans music from Mac, who did much the same on his album Gumbo back in the 70s. To start things off, I asked him what the focus was for him on this new album.
I was trying to figure to make a picture of how some kind of way that we could take people on some kind of little spiritual journey, show the little bit of the spiritual side of New Orleans, take them to my kind of pictures of the streets, and then take them to back to the spiritual zone, which is kind of how life is.
Mm-hmm.
But New Orleans style life.
And actually, one of the things that just reaches out and grabs you on this record are the choirs, the choruses, which is kind of a side of you know, when you think of gospel, sometimes you think of the quartets or the single singers, but so much of what happens in the church are those choirs.
You know, these guys, Wardell Cassidy, just arranged this record to the max, but what that he offset on this on the Saints Go Marching In.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Staples puts the icing on the cake, but the icing was, to me, laid down already by DeVell Crawford singers for us to get some inspiration right off the wheel.
Let's listen to that. What happened when they all came? It all comes together. This is When the Saints Go Marching In from Dr. John's new album.
When the Saints. Counted in that glory number. Oh, yes, I do. Angel Gabriel start to blow his golden horn. I wanna be there with all the saints and angels. Yeah, when the
When the Saints Go Marching In, we're talking with Dr. John about New Orleans Dis Dadder Dudder, and one of the things about this record, that right off the bat, we're talking about the Vel Crawford singers who just set up. Mavis Staples is one of the guests on here, and Dr. John. Now, I've talked with you in the past about how your dad serviced jukeboxes, and I'm wondering where the church, and I know that led to sort of an education in music you'd bring home, but how did the church figure in there? Did you live near a church, or did you?
He was my third guitar teacher, Roy Montrell. In fact, I was just talking to his daughter the other day, Rarlene, and we were talking about that how that he used to send me to sub on his gigs with his aunt, sister Elizabeth Eustace, who was a missionary preacher, and she used to go to all the different churches in New Orleans, and I'd go be her guitarist, and she was his piano player and singer. And she was a very intimidating lady. But she turned me on to a lot of people that became a big part of my life. And the main one that always sticks out to me was Deacon Frank Lasty in his spiritual church in New Orleans in the Ninth Ward. It was like, it just changed my life. There was something about going into their house, which was the church, and, like, little kids could do anything there. It was like, that's what it just seems correct. And it was like the little kids was the angels. The women were the saints. And it was just something real. It was just a different way of looking at it all, you know. So it turned me out.
You brought up, you know, your guitar teachers, but a lot of people may not know that you changed instruments. Why did you change from guitar to piano?
Well, in 1960, I got shot in my finger in my left hand, and you bend strings with the fourth finger from the thumb, you know, the it's kind of, and they sewed it back on, but it doesn't have any real feeling in it, so. It's kind of, when I play guitar, it's not dependable to use.
Yeah, does piano playing get more difficult as you get older?
Well, it's not that it gets more difficult, but I just realize sometimes it's like I got to adjust things to things that's happened in life, and you just mellow out a little bit. But it's like, I think if you ever get too satisfied with stuff you do, then you're going backwards in this thing. So I just try to keep doing something. And from not being formally trained on a keyboard, I mean, like, the closest to formal keyboard training I had was James Booker taught me how to play a Hammond B3 organ for a gig that... that really changed my life. That was my first formal keyboard gig. My lessons kind of stopped when the gig started.
Did you get a chance to gig a lot yourself during that period?
That's what I did to make a listen. I mean, I had to do a lot of things to make a living back in the 50s and the 60s that were like that. You know, I worked as a record producer, a studio musician. I worked on gigs, all of that, and still couldn't make my nut. So there it is. We didn't make a lot of money. Union scale was very low. We didn't earn that much of money doing recording dates. We made not that much money playing gigs, but we loved the music. So we wanted to play music. George Davis and me were talking about this the other day, how much we wanted to play that we never really thought about the business end of any side of it.
Now, did you go to I know you went to L.A. at a certain point. Did you go there to try to make some money, or what was that about?
Well, put it this way. New Orleans had kind of folded gig-wise. It wasn't like Jim Garrison had kind of shut everything down there. All the music strips were going down fast. The clubs were being padlocked, so when you padlocked a club in New Orleans, it meant it wasn't going to reopen. No other DA had did this prior. They shut them down for a while, cleaned up whatever it was, but they didn't padlock them close. And he did this. And anyway, so I was sort of coerced into leaving New Orleans. And wound up in Los Angeles, which wasn't a real place I ever had eyes to go. I always looked at going out there was kind of like going where Hopalong Cassidy or, Errol Flynn or whatever, you know, Humphrey Bogart. That's what it represented to me. I never wanted to really be anywhere west of the Mississippi River. To me, that was kind of my boundary. Texas was kind of scary. So I could figure the real wild, wild west was out there. I didn't expect when I got there to be what was wild about it was the surf or something, you know. But then you live and you learn stuff, and there it is.
Well, another thing people may not know is that the first Dr. John album, as such, the Grigory album, was cut in L.A., now, where did the musical inspiration come from that? Was that have to do with the arrangers you work with? Because I got to tell you, there were a lot of psychedelic albums then, and this is the one, for whatever reason, felt more authentic to me as a listener when it came out.
Well, it was to me, it was just a picture of, I was trying to do a record in some kind of way that painted a picture of New Orleans Grigory, which had basically separate and distinct from Haitian Grigory, African Grigory, which is what people call voodoo, but it's New Orleans version of it, or even just South Louisiana version of it. And it's kind of that, and it's. I took a lot of folk tales and mixed them in, but I tried to paint a picture. It was very true to the music, and I didn't know that it was going to come out at a time when the psychedelical era was popping, and people thought when they saw us doing a show with, you know, a lot of feathers and smoke and whatever, that we was psychedelical.
How did you know so much about voodoo?
Well, you know, it's part of New Orleans culture. I don't think there's, no matter what anybody from New Orleans may or may not tell you, I think you'll see pretty much, you go in somebody's home, there's something somewhere, like behind a door or up on a wall or something. It's pretty straight up Grigory stuff. I can remember my aunt married this good Catholic lady in the middle of a hurricane, reaching in a little bag and throwing some stuff out the door. And while she had a little thing, a piece of skin or something with some words from a psalm read on it and burning a candle and all of this in the middle. As a little kid, and I didn't know what the, you know, I didn't know what was going on. I was an innocent kid. But it stuck out, and then my grandmother used to do some strange things. But there was all, that was all around me. I mean, I used to love to go, and I was attracted to it all. It's like there was like people all around me. I mean, I walk in a Cracker Jack drugstore, and there's like a monkey's paw and some sand in a jar. And, you know, like all kind of things that you could just, wow. For a kid, you know, it was like, wow, look at that. So it was, there was a lot of mixture of all of that in various of the churches in New Orleans. Things overlap in New Orleans in a strange way that it's hard to find where something creeped in the back door or in the side door, the window, wherever, and became a part of something that don't really have anything to do with the other thing.
Right. Well, is that still going on? Is it still a part of it?
Well, it's not as much, because when I came up, all these ladies, these Reverend Mothers in New Orleans and all, they did like a community service. They healed people that couldn't afford to go to hospitals. They did a lot of great things. You know, and they were part of a community, and it wasn't looked at as something else. You know, and there was a lot of you know, today, I look at a lot of that today, is a lot of hustle involved with a lot of things today. I'm very cynical about where things is going in line where this world has become a little overbearingly money-crazed in that area. That's a spiritual area that, you know, but then if I look in TV at some healing preachers sometime or whatever, and I look at this and that, and everybody's hustling you, it's always the money. You can send me your credit card number. You can. It's like credit card churches. You know, it's like one on bandit churches almost or something, you know.
Amen to that. Let's go back and play Walk on Gilded Splinters, going all the way back with our guest today, Dr. John.
Some people think they jive me, but I know they must be crazy. Don't see their misfortune, else they're just lazy. Je suis a grand zombie, my yellow belt of Charizard. Ain't afraid of no tomcat, fill my brains with poison. Walk through the fire, fly through the smoke. See my enemy at the end of their rope. Walk on pins and needles, see what they can do. Walk on gilded splinters with a cane of the Zulu. Dang, I'm gonna
come on, make it a compound. Walk on gilded splinters.
Did I put
up?
Roll out my coffin, drink poison in my chalice. Pride begins to fade, and y'all feel my malice. Put Gregory on your doorstep, soon you'll be in the gutter. Melt your heart like butter, I can make you stutter. Bring a light of corn, make kill it, corn, corn. Walk on, kill the splinter. Walk on, make kill it, corn, corn.
A bit of I Walk on Gilded Splinters, going all the way back with Dr. John, our guest today. He's got a new album called Dr. John, New Orleans, Dis Dat or the Other. You know, a while ago we were talking with the festival producer George Ween about going back in the, I guess in the 50s, maybe in the early 60s, down to New Orleans to talk about doing a jazz festival. And there was all kinds of hassle about blacks and whites at the same concert and all that. And I was curious what your perspective was. I mean, you were one of the few white guys in these sessions. Were you completely accepted at the time, or what did that feel like?
Listen, I never ever, and I think I speak for anybody on either side of the fence. The musicians didn't care about anything but the music. It wasn't about race, creed, whatever, you know. It wasn't about, nothing but the music. If you could play good, you cut it, okay. And the problems I ran into came up from the musicians' union.
Hmm.
I started mixing recording sessions between what was the two segregated unions, and that became a problem. With the two unions, not with any of the musicians. It's that prior to that, the white union had all of their sessions, the black union had all of theirs, and all of a sudden here I did ones that mixed guys from both unions, and then it was like I had to pay if it was run through the white union, and we did things very dumb and goofy. We made the leader of recording sessions go around who was leader on the last session out the basic studio guys. And we didn't have a real system, so that one day we'd have a big mix session that was going through the black union or the white union. And it caused confusion that neither union wanted nobody from the other union picking their checks up. So basically, I had to pay everybody at my house for the session. So, but it was like it was a very comical maneuver, but it's how life goes.
Came down to money in that situation. There you go. Mac, there is a special language you talk. I mean, with, you know, Nova Scotians and Destively Bonnaroo, and I'm pointing to a song in here, Such a Much, the one that you sing with Willie Nelson. Is that language you talk, assuming you didn't make it all up, still around? Do people talk like you talk in portions of New Orleans?
Hey, listen, that song there, Such a Much, it's some old Cousin Joe song. I did a lot of his songs on this record, and he just, him and a lot of guys like him, Professor Longhair, all had a little thing that led me to wherever I'm at with. Look, I could talk the King's English to you right now, but I prefer to do what I do.
We do, too.
You see what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, let's listen to that one, because this is one that you and Willie Nelson cut together. And
Snooks Eglin, too, plays a fine guitar solo and sings the out verse.
All right. This is Such a Much.
Give a crippled crab a crutch. Wouldn't give a blind pig an acorn. Wouldn't give a crippled crab a crutch. Baby, you and your food stamps, you know you ain't so such a much. Now, old settlers. Sellers know just what to do. Old sellers know just what to do. They give you all kind of good old loving, some good old money too.
Well, my woman is phony. Phony as a shoplifter's alibi. I said my woman is phony. As phony as a shoplifter's alibi. Every time I catch her wrong, a girl comes up with a different lie. Now if I want to catch her in a crooked act, all I do is throw a brick at the front door and then run around to the back. Cause my woman is phony as a shoplifter's alibi. Every time I catch her wrong, the girl comes up with a different lie.
You ain't such a much. That is Dr. John from New Orleans, Dis Dat or Da Utter, in our conversation recorded back in 2004. We wanted to replay that one to give a sense of the culture that is in danger of being lost in New Orleans.